You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, August 12th, 2012, and this is the Webcomic Beacon Newscast with Fess of the Webcast Beacon.
I'm Fess!
And of EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Terry.
Hello, everyone.
And of AlexsGuide.net, Alex Heberling.
I'm Alex!
And I, of course, am Jason Strasberg, the news editor for the show. Welcome. And here's the news for this week. We will begin with our top story, having to deal with, of course, funny junk. We all know that Charles Carrion is the lawyer who tried to sue the internet, but if you think back before Carrion went to the crazy place and then started building a second home there, he was representing a website called Funny Junk. When Funny Junk's attempt to at censorship of the webcomic The Oatmeal went bad, Carrion got most of the negative blowback instead of the owners of the site. For a simple reason, no one knew who owned Funny Junk. For years, the ownership of the site has been shrouded in mystery. The admins of the site going out of their way to block the knowledge of the true owners of the site. In his last Ars Technica article, Nate Anderson goes on a journey to find the man behind Funny Junk, and it takes him through layers of lawyers and shell corporations to eventually find a name of an individual more secretive than the great Oz himself. The owner of Funny Junk, or so it seems. Because lately Funny Junk has advertised that they are under new management, it is the site has actually been bought by someone else, or has it been an attempt to hide again? This is the question that no one seems to answer. Ars Technica attempts to answer it, but still, they are blocked. If you want to go and check out this article at Ars Technica, you're welcome to. And if I honestly think if anyone knows anything, because it sounds like a missing persons report, please submit something. I've never heard so much mystery behind the owner of a website. That's our top story, so something to think on. And now I'm going to take you over to the Buzz section with Marie. Marie?
Oh, thank you. We have three stories in the Buzz today. Our first story, fans of Joss Whedon, or who love this year's Avengers movie, will be pleased to hear that Whedon will continue to contribute directly to Marvel Studios for the next few years, at least through 2015. Whedon wrote that and directed the smash hit Avengers. So if you like the film as much as a lot of us did, it's probably good to hear that he'll be involved in upcoming Marvel Studio Ventures. We have two links on the stories with more details. So look in the links at geeksofdoom.com and bleedingcool.com in the show notes for more details. Our second story involves the evolution of comics. Comics as an art form has always struggled for respectability in the United States, but not strangely enough in places like Japan. And to our surprise, it's 2012, and we're still facing the notion that comics are for kids. Still, there's been a slow evolution towards comics for adults and adult respectability. And this week, there's a fascinating 6-panel history of the evolution of our favorite art form, commissioned by Professor Paul Lopes of Demanding Respect, the Evolution of the American Comic Book. Check out the link to robot6.com and see if you can spot all the historical comical cultural references in this clever 6-panel piece. Our third story, V for Vendetta co-creator David Lloyd launches a new digital imprint, Aces Weekly. According to Comics Alliance, V for Vendetta co-creator David Lloyd will be launching his own digital series called Aces Weekly. The series will feature exclusive creator-owned content with assurances to the readers that the comic creators will actually be getting a significant piece of the pie for their own work. If you're interested in seeing the original creative work that isn't churned out by a corporate factory and think that creators following their own vision is a good thing, you may want to keep an eye out for Aces Weekly. See the link to Comics Alliance .com in the show notes for more details. And that's all we've got today in the Buzz. Back to you, Jason.
Okay, thanks, Marie. Next up, we are going to go to business, and that is me. So we're going to start out with a nice story about Penny Arcade. And the question, did Penny Arcade's Kickstarter project fail? A lot of people think so. Over at flesheatingzipper.com, the author, merely known as N, has a look at how much money the Penny Arcade gang managed to raise so far through Kickstarter and what they were offering to donors in return. The author's conclude that it looks like a pretty big failure so far, although at the moment the project still has a little time left. The smart money says that there won't be a sudden last-minute rush of donations, but let's see what happens next week, and we can all be the judge. And if you want to check out the link at flesheatingzipper.com, it'll be there or in the show notes. Next up is a thing about marketing strategy and paying for promotion. Coming to us this week from GigaOM is the story of how Uber, U-B-E-R, became the hip new app. Uber is an app that allows the user to summon a cab for free with a touch. So how did something like that people could accomplish with the iPhone function or their phone become so popular? The trick was that a marketing campaign where you could use Uber to summon ice cream trucks in the summer, you still had to pay for the service and the ice cream, but that didn't seem to advance the effectiveness of the campaign. As the article states, and Broderick, who was being interviewed, explained that any startup could stand on its street corner and yell "free ice cream," but rolling out paid ice cream trucks specifically create an experience similar to the one the overall brand promotes, paying more for an on-demand product with an elevated experience. The Uber strategy offers a unique look at the marketing that takes into account both viral marketing and establishing the customer habits, something that webcomics should take notice of and try to emulate. So check out the article at GigaOM, and you can get a more depth definition of what's going on here. Okay, and I think this is our last story in business. It's basically about a Kickstarter for porn.
Hooray!
I didn't think you guys were asleep, but now I know you're not. Okay, finally, from GigaOM, we're introduced to the tragically named website Offbeater, spelled O-F-F-B-E-A-T-R, which is trying to reinvent the porn industry with a Kickstarter-style crowdfunding model. The site will allow creators of adult movies, books, art installations, and anything else that falls under the category of not safe for work, a place to post their projects and attach a funding goal. Backers will then pledge donations that, like Kickstarter, will only be used if the project is fully funded. Projects will be put through an approval process so Offbeater can select the more serious proposals, but there's a kink here that differs from Kickstarter being the site...
A kink, you say?
A kink, I say. But we're allowed some puns. Come on. But anyways. How it differs from Kickstarter, if you're listening, is that the site will also use crowdsourcing for curation. So in other words, projects that have a large community support and fan base won't fall for the cracks of their approval process. Something else that differs from Kickstarter is that Offbeater will allow creators to sell digital content via their website. So Offbeater projects seem to have a new and unique ways to get their projects funded. So you should take a look at it if you're looking for some new crowdfunding ideas, but please just do us a favor and do yourself a favor and wait till you're on your own computer, because the site is most definitely not safe for work. All right, that is the end of our business news, and now I'd like to take you over to Education with Alex.
It is a beautiful day in the Education neighborhood this week with two stories. And first up is Mr. Rogers' epic four-hour interview about children's programming. There's a good chance that if you grew up as a kid any time in the last 40 or 50 years, you remember Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Over at themarysue.com, they've unearthed an epic four-hour interview with the late Fred Rogers on his opinions on children's television. Although we all know that comics are not for kids, an awful lot of us still developed our love for comics as children, and some comics creators still do make comics for kids, and if comics for kids are your passion, you might find this television icon's thoughts on producing for kids worthwhile. See the link to themarysue.com in the show notes. Next up, University of Chicago is posting their Comics Philosophy and Practice series online. The ever-reliable Cleefield on Comics has clued us into the University of Chicago's site, where they're posting full videos of their Comics Philosophy and Practice conference that took place in May. As of this recording, there are only two videos up, but more should be coming. It's worth watching, so check it out. That is it for Education.
All right. Thanks, Alex. We are going to go right into it with Tech with Vess.
Oh, me? Me already? Oh, wow, geez. My debut on No, wait, I've been here before. All right, with tech news, we only have a couple of items here. First up, as far as digital comics go, you can now sync your Marvel app with Comixology. Because apparently before, while Marvel apps and digital comics were still powered by Comixology, you needed the Marvel app to access things with the site, and they weren't connected before for whatever reason. So now you can all just sync it all together, and you don't have to worry about it. So good on for those people that utilize those particular apps. Moving on, we have a so-called game changer, as color print-on-demand just got a lot more affordable. Or so we're told here. Finding both a link from The Beat at Comics Beat, as well as Publishers Weekly. Let's see here. We have essentially the Ingram Content Group has announced a new standard color pricing model for its POD tech and has reduced the cost to about 2/3, which could mean quite a... Hang on, I'll cut that out. Which would mean quite a lot of difference for people that are trying to print large trade paperbacks that are more than just like 24 or 32 pages for like your standard comic book. And this is something that has got to be investigated a little bit more to see what their of course, print quality is with that. Exactly what are they doing differently? And so, we'll get a link to that in the show notes, as well as to the Ingram's page for, I think you need to send out, like, a proposal. It's not like a POD site that a lot of us are used to where you can just go ahead and plug everything in and order instantly. It looks like you have to actually contact him first and get a quote. So, and that is it for tech, basically. Sorry, my phone is going off. Throw that far away. I'll edit this.
And also, thanks to me for pointing out the article, Fett.
Who are you?
Special thanks to Alex for pointing us to the article.
Well, fine then. At alexsguide.net. And next off, we're moving off to... Are we moving to Tidbits?
That's correct. Tidbits with Alex.
Yay, me. First up in Tidbits, Sex in Comics, the top 100 strangest, suggestive, and steamy vintage comic book panels of all time. Fans of vintage comics will probably find this extremely funny. Blogger Mitch O'Connell has taken 100 images out of classic comics and put an out-of-context and perverse spin on it. One of our personal favorites from a vintage Batman. Robin, thanks. Whew, my knees are still wobbly. And the constant, as well as the constant misuse of the word boner, when it apparently meant something very different than it does now. For more such juvenile comic fun, check out mitchoconnell.blogspot.com in the show notes. And next up, why do webcomics update most on Wednesdays? Cleefield, one of our favorite Cleefields of all time. Cleefield on Comics has taken some time to analyze the significance of Wednesday as New Comics Day. The evidence he's unearthed points to the fact that Wednesdays are an artifact of business decisions made by Diamond and Marvel. When Marvel's own distribution arm was shut down, Diamond changed their own release date to fit the House of Ideas pricing schedule, and other comic houses had to follow suit. So all of it looks pretty arbitrary, especially for digital comics, but it's a good history lesson. You can check out the whole article on Cleefield's site or go to the show notes to get the link. That is it for the tidbits.
When I wrote that copy, I was wondering, the misuse of boner. Is there a misuse of the word boner?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot.
Okay.
If you...
Yeah, I had while we were recording, I had a couple of boners while I was reading my copies for tech.
Moving on. All right. We're going to go on to Oddities with Marie.
All right. We got three stories in the Oddities today. And the first one is superheroes are the tools of the 1%. Comrades, Superman is a tool of the capitalist swine. Batman is an oppressor of the proletarian. I hate
that. It's okay.
Is it proletariat? proletariat. Okay, there it is. So the people at Works World Unite, the world-renowned communist newsletter, want us to know. No, we're not kidding. Check this out to the workersworldunite.org in the show notes. And Viva la Revolution, running pig dogs. All right. Didn't come out.
I feel like I should be wearing a red beret.
Woo! All right. Our second story is quite odd. Apparently, a man ordered a TV on Amazon, but was shipped an assault rifle. Imagine ordering a new high-definition TV a few days ago through Amazon, and then when the third-party merchant, and then when the package arrives, you open it, and you find a really, really, really big gun.
I wanted to play Code of Honor, but this is ridiculous.
it's real.
It's a really, really big gun.
Not to mention that particular gun was illegal to possess or transport in Washington, D.C., I believe, is where this guy is.
It's this poor guy. Anyway, probably some kind of mistake that will be very swiftly rectified. But, you know, it's one of those really embarrassing times to call, or even kind of like, do you call customer service? Because it is illegal to happen. Yeah, it's like, oh my God. So if you'd like to read more about this story, it comes from a number of sources, idle.slash.org, dcis.com, and thetelegraph.co.uk. The link's in the show notes. But wow, what a gun. that would be a surprise. Our last article, if you were for the children of the 90s, this might be relevant to you. If you were just born in the late 90s, well, this might be less relevant to you. It's not really comic news, but it is definitely odd. Apparently, Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny of The X-Files, if you remember them from the 90s, have apparently both left their relationships to be with one another. This is a rumor, and I'm sure we can all feel a little better in a world where television romances play into real life. Admit it, you were hoping that it was going to happen anyway.
You can read all of it
at International Business Times website, which the link is in the show notes. And that's all of the oddities we have today. Back to you, Jason.
We try to find some odd things, yes.
That oddity is like 15 years too late.
Yeah, 15. I try maybe a little bit more than that. I don't know. Did we skip over education? Oh, we did that already.
We did that. Well, it's yes.
Well, pay no mind to me.
And now we're going to take a short break to pay the bills, so we'll see you in a couple minutes.
Once again, we have a sponsor for the Webcomic Beacon newscast, Sean Granger of the graphic novel Family Bones. Once again, sponsors us with telling us to check out his website at kingtractorpress.com, where you can check out the webcomics Daddy's Girls and the sci-fi thriller Gene Gardens. That's at kingtractorpress.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at WebcomicZ. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We are also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at WebcastBeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
And welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon newscast. And you have reached our discussion portion. And once again, we are here with, from evilspacecat.com, Marie Terry.
Hello, internets.
And Alex's Guide, and alexsguide.net, Alex Heberling.
Be our guest, be our guest.
Stop it. And I'm Jason. And also, Fess is with us. He is our quote-unquote guest today, but we're very to have him here and constantly monitoring us, and
I'm guest.
Everybody be on your best behavior, okay?
Oh, I'm dying.
Please don't. So we want to go into a lot of talk has come up about the new price changes and POD printing. And Fess, I know that you, when you were doing the article reporting, you had some – I mean, there's definitely quality to mm-hmm. think about. But, I mean, do you think that this is really a breakthrough?
I'd have to see. Okay, for one thing, this article was talking for large numbered page trade paperbacks. And I don't have that much experience with that. I don't know people who do. I did want to mention that, okay, I apologize for not being able to get this video out any sooner. But I was getting one of my comics printed, like a 32-page full-color comic printed through, let's say, RA Comics Depot, Comics Press, Kablam, and IC Geeks. Basically for print-on-demand services to try to compare and contrast them. I still need to make the video. I promise I will do that really soon. To compare and contrast, but I can just tell you, essentially, they all pretty much look the same. The biggest differences are going to be in paper, maybe a little bit of the hue. This looks a little bit more red, or this looks a little bit more blue, which just could be ink levels. I mean, it's digital printing. It's not offset printing. And I'm pretty sure that this POD that they're doing as well is also digital printing, because print on demand usually means that you don't need your 2,000 minimum before it's. I mean, it's like I've looked at things where you can get like offset printing for like less than like 2,000, but as far as like cost per, it's not worth it until you have at least like a 2,000 unit. Minimum, at least for comic book size. Anyway, so I'm going to probably investigate with this more and see if they can do smaller, like comic book issue sizes, and see if the price is that dramatic for that few of pages. Maybe the price is only dramatic for the larger trades. Either way, this is very, very good for small time. Creators, and I'll be really interested to see what their quality is and how well people work with this. I mean, it could be like a stepped thing. Like the example in the article is at 500 books. Still, that's not as much of a commitment as 2,000, and price per book is still fantastic. So,
well, I was looking at the article. I mean, I've produced large books before as part of my work, so I kind of have an idea of how much price and I'm working through conventional printers as opposed to, say, a print-on-demand, and I have printed my own books as well. I'm a bit of a print snob. I've sent work jobs back because they weren't up to my standards, even digital jobs. So I do know like there are variants where there is, you know, good printing and there's bad printing even in the digital world. And I was looking at it, and they're talking about taking a 120-page trade paperback specifically, so I'm guessing it would be a perfect bound book, at the sort of manga size of 6x9. And they're saying that it would run about in the range of 12 to 13, which is about accurate from everything I found, because I'm actually looking at producing right now a trade paperback of one of my comics of about 120 pages, ironically. But it says that it would take the standard color down to from that same book, which now is sitting at about $12 to $13, down to like $4 to $5 to produce that same book. I wonder a little bit about what kind of binding they're doing. But yeah, like the price difference is very significant, although they say it's a high-speed color inkjet printing as opposed to the toner printing that's standardly used with most print-on-demand services. Like it's not always inkjet that they're using. So I'm kind of wondering like what this is going to do to the paper, how much soakage we're going to get on high color coverage. I'm wondering like, you know, like what, you know, it says that Lightning Source, which is a print-on-demand, like you can order one book or you can order 5 zillion, is rolling out this technology like immediately, apparently. And so I'm wondering if this is going to show up on specifically Lightning Source's books, because they've been primarily, as far as I understand, used mostly for like novels and stuff. Like they're not as much comic book publishers. They are more of a novel publisher, but it looks like they're going to probably try to go branch into stuff like children's books and comics. I know they did print comics, but I think they did primarily like more like the black and whites with color covers. And I saw their color covers and I was not impressed. They were highly, there was a lot of grain in them. It looked really, really dotty. Which actually was kind of almost noisy. Like there was just a lot of the screening was crap. So I never aspired to use them, and it was kind of one of those things where, you know, it makes me curious. I really do want to see what they do. I know that Kablam has a fairly reasonable price for their trade paperback, but it's certainly not in the $4 to $5 range for 120 pages.
No. I've printed Garanos with Kablam for years, and even the shortest book is like book 2 or 3, and even that is still at least $13 per book.
With, how many pages?
Around 150.
Yeah, there's kind of a magic sweet spot in their numbering system where it's like it goes, it dips underneath $10 or something, or it's about $10. And once you go over that, even by like 2 pages, it feels too expensive. So it's like you have to keep it in kind of that sweet spot of their pricing model.
Well, also,
it's hard to compare.
Kablam has also recently changed some of their pricing. The Saddle Stitch, and they're now offering. The Saddle Stitch, like the maximum, has been reduced to a maximum of 44 pages for Saddle Stitch. And then above 44 pages is now Perfect Bound. So they brought down the number of pages you need for Perfect Bound. They've changed something recently, and their prices have changed a bit as well. So it's something to look into. So if anybody has any experience with using their new Saddle Stitch or Perfect Bound at some of those numbers, let us know. We'd be curious and share that information.
And something to point out too with the Ingram POD project is that they only don't offer Saddle Stitch books. You can get Perfect Bound, you can get like Wire Coil Bound, or I think you can get hardback too, but if you are doing a comic that is small enough or short enough to be Saddle Stitch, you're still going to be using like Kablam or CreateSpace or some other print-on-demand printer.
Well, generally, I mean, the rule of thumb with all print is that the more you get, the cheaper it gets. So, you know, and it's always been kind of an economy of scale when you print with a printer, because to ink up the presses or even to use, like, the digital, you know, to run have the people there to run the machines, it's expensive. Mm-hmm. So, because they are fairly highly trained individuals for the most part. I mean, unless you're going to, like, you know, Kinko's and whatever, doing it yourself, and it's probably not going to be amazing. But, you know, like I don't know that, you know, you're going to see, like when I bought my book through two different, I did one book, like a 32 page book through two different groups, and it was Kablam and Lightning, or not Lightning Source. I forget what their other name was, but they're a relatively newcomer to the sort of, group. And, it was only like a couple of bucks. It was like $3 or whatever per unit. So it wasn't actually that bad, like, and they were relatively comparable as far as their prices went.
All the 4 PODs that I mentioned: Kablam, Comics Press, Comics with an X, IC Geeks Publishing, as well as RA Comics Department, all fairly comparable. Though IC Geeks was like a whole dollar less, and RA Comics Department had a minimum of 25, and I think they were just a little bit more expensive, but they also offered an overnight processing.
Yes, it was RA printers. It was RA that I did the other book with, because I wanted the speed, because I couldn't wait for Kablam. I liked Kablam's printing better than, like, it actually, like, in terms of I could compare the two and go and rant. But I did find that they were great communicators. They shipped fast. They were easy to work with. I mean, it was really nice. The pages were, they did need time to dry. Otherwise, they looked weird. So once they dried, they looked good, or something happened and they looked better than when I first got them. I don't know what was up with that. But because I think it was still a photocopy job.
Do you wear contacts or anything like that? No.
No, I don't. But I was like, when I got it, I don't want to go into it, but after a little while, I guess it set or something, and it was better. It looked better than when I first got it. It looked kind of kissed, and the page looked weird. there was a lot of grain. And there's still actually more sort of noise, and it's a darker print job, generally speaking, than what Kablam is doing. But Kablam also has a very odd way of setting up their files. And
yeah, they need RGB files, so you need to convert your...
Can't even send a PDF. It's crazy. Yeah.
They're the only ones that are so weird. I mean, it's like you have to convert your CMYK. Yeah, I would recommend...
Yeah. 2 months to get it.
Really?
It's ridiculous. Well, yeah, like unless you're willing to pay like a whole lot more.
How long ago was that?
Last year.
I got my Ardor books within a month, I think. I might have picked a different shipping time, but...
My issue with Kablam and why I'm probably not going to be ordering from them again is that for like the last 4 or 5 orders I've had from them, I've put in my notes that, hey, I have to have this for this convention on this date, and then I get the UPS shipping notification on Friday morning when I'm about to when I'm either already at the convention or going to leave.
It might be time.
I'm not going to complain about that, but I also ordered like 5 weeks in advance.
And I've ordered up to 2 months in advance in most cases, and at least 6 weeks in advance, which has been the sort of typical turnaround for me up until they started messing up my shipping dates so much. And I mean, they have those ship dates guaranteed by that you pick when you go through the ordering process, and my orders were not being shipped by those guaranteed.
Were you compensated for that?
No.
Okay.
I would have.
You guys are working with the big trade books, though, right? I've only have experience with.
No, I was only. It shouldn't make a difference. 32 page books, like saddle stitch books.
It should not make a difference whether I'm ordering a saddle stitch or my big Garanos volumes. If they have a guaranteed ship by date, the ordering.
No, right. You should have been compensated. I mean, I've worked with them, and I've had an order, like the amount that I ordered was mixed up. I ordered 20 of one and 25 of another. I got 20 of both. They apologized and they gave me credit. And I also had another order of Ardor books where one of their archived images wasn't updated for the barcode on the back. And so I got a shipment that didn't have the barcode. They gave me a credit, which was, so granted there were issues with them, but I don't know. I've had a really good experience. So they can vary so much.
But that's just not been my experience. And I just don't really just want to deal with it anymore.
So I'm going to look into
Ingram. If it works
Ingram.
For you, people listening to this, you're allowed to like Kablam. I'm not saying that. I just don't
I'd say that their print quality was really good. Like what I got was fantastic. Yeah. Like the work I got was good. My complaint is with their turnaround time and the way that they don't, like, I'm used to having printers that are more, I guess, collaborative. Like, I'm used to being able to talk to a print rep and go to a print shop and actually, like, watch it come off the press. Like, that's the kind of hands-on that I'm used to. So, like, not being able to talk to somebody there who has, like, some kind of printing background that I can kind of talk the lingo with and say, like, okay, here's what I want, here's what, I remember actually when I ordered, there was a postal strike in Canada, and I actually asked for it to be shipped in a particular fashion because using a certain courier, like they were offering a couple of different options, and I asked for a certain one and they didn't ship with the one I asked for because they made a decision to go more economical, but I needed it by a certain time. So, I was compensating, and I wrote in the notes that there was a postal strike and it had to be shipped this way, and they ignored me. So there's definitely something going on there that I don't understand. And I also don't understand what this whole, the wait time is, because for any standard publisher, they should be able to turn it around in about a week and a half and that's a long time. 3 days is like rush standard, industry standard. Unless you're printing really big books because you have to go through binding time. So I could see having a slightly longer turnaround for like trade paperbacks because you got to wait for the glue to dry. But, that's still like a week and a half, like tops, like for turnaround if you're looking for fast stuff. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just because they are smaller shops and they are not running, bigger machines that can do this stuff quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they're doing they're running it. But if they have the machines, like, I don't see why.
Right.
It's a problem.
The difference is on this, I'm looking at the Ingram Content website for their POD section. It's clear to point out that their standard color is what is the cheaper option versus their premium color. And I don't know exactly. I'm gonna actually try to contact them and see what up. But their premium color actually takes 70-pound paper. Their standard color takes 50-pound paper. So there's a difference in the paper. I don't know if there's, like, more colors that are going to be available in their premium color. Like, if somebody's...
I doubt it.
Like, if somebody's, it's like, doing, like, an RG...
four-color process.
Well, if it's standard four-color... that's the thing. I don't think that Kablam, ComExpress, or any of those are using standard four-color. I believe they're using six- or eight-color, because that's the only way that you can somewhat recreate RGB accurately.
Well, no, that's not true. You can do it with CYMK.
No, you can't.
Yes, you can.
No, you won't.
If they're properly calibrated. But that's the thing, is they have to be properly calibrated, and they have to be really reasonably new machines. And if they've calibrated their machine specifically to RGB, then if that's why they're going to want their files in RGB. I'm guessing they're dealing with people who aren't print savvy,
right,
who are sending them RGB files all the time, which would make some kind of sense if their machines are tweaked to it. And I'm reasonably sure that they're using something like a large Canon Xerox, which, as far as I know, uses four colors.
Yeah, but you can't just take light and convert it into pigment. You won't get your rich bright cyans.
No, but you can tweak it so that there is better color than if it's calibrated to CYMK. Then when you go from RGB color to CYMK, you're going to see a noticeable darkening, which is what I saw in the RA stuff.
Right.
It's just I didn't compensate. My screen was not properly calibrated for CYMK output. But if you are going back, if you are calibrating your machines to what the standard of what most people's default screens are, and you are compensating for that as part of the RIP process, then it's going to be brighter because it's going to know to change to have the colors at a certain level.
I think,
but like, there are not. You don't generally see a large Xerox with extra colors. You only see it in inkjet.
I think we could have a whole webcomic beacon.
Yeah, I was
going to
say that we're kind of spinning
this
off here, but
let's try to schedule
that. The drinking game along at home.
Yeah. So let's move on.
I just want to say one quick thing, though. Marie, do you have a reference? Because I know this kind of went over my head, too. Is there some place that someone who's looking to print a book, I mean, not based on price, but on if they had a choice of doing CMYK or RGB, I mean, is there a reference?
Well, as far as most professional printers are concerned, mm-hmm. you better be working in CYMK.
Okay, that's what
I've they're going to look at you sideways, or they're going to basically send it to their prepress department, and they're going to convert it into CYMK.
And then they're going to.
I mean, I work in this all the time. I've done graphic design and book design and brochure design and everything else for like over a decade now. I know what I'm doing. And
we believe you. We really yes.
Four color process is standard. CYMK is standard. Like on any other press, of any press that you ever go on is going to have four heads unless you're doing a special spot or a varnish or something. So, I mean, there are presses out there with eight heads, but most of them only ink the four. And then they will only put on extra colors if you have actually specifically specified them as spots or varnishes. And they're not actually mixed as part of it. Generally speaking, that's not done unless there's like a special application. So you don't actually see that. But if you wanted to get something printed, like a book or something properly printed, what I actually suggest you do is do some research in your area, find out what printers are there, and actually work with a printer to see, you know, like do some research, get some material that they've printed, find out who their clients are. Talk to their print rep. You know, they should be willing to give you samples of what they can do, mm-hmm. and you can look at it, and you can ask them specifically. It's like, well, I'm looking to do a book. Can you please mm-hmm. give me a sample of a book? Like, I'm in Vancouver, BC. There is a bazillion printers here. There's also a bazillion printers in Canada. Like, we've printed. We have a newsprint calendar that we do for the university, and it gets printed by a place called Van Press, and they get. And then they're great. They're wonderful and they're amazing, but they don't do the color portion. They only do the black and white portion. And then they outsource the other port, like the cover of it, to another printer who does that. And we liaison with that person to make sure that the covers are correct. And it's quite a big process. Like it's definitely, if you've never been through it, it can be very stressful, especially if you're spending your own money. And it can be very expensive because most of these professional printers are not looking for small jobs. They're not going to do 100 books. They're not going to do 200 books. They're going to be looking at doing like 5,000 books. So you have to have – that's like when you're doing like a Kickstarter or something. You want to go and you want to talk to them and see what they can do and, you know, what's going to go, what exactly you want so that you get a good, accurate quote. And you should get quotes from more than one printer because generally speaking, when you're sourcing a job, you want to at least compare three to four quotes.
And if you're definitely that, if that going offset is out of your price range, the POD, you can get one printed and compare like that. But to be honest, I don't know. We can talk. We can schedule another show another time, specifically talking about printing options. But we should probably move on.
We're gonna we're gonna run out of time, and I want to get to the porn. Well, the Kickstarter for porn.
Don't we all?
So, this website Offbeater. It's an interesting concept, and in fact, the second that flared up, all that you see is articles about Offbeater right now. But what's kind of extricate the not safe for work content and talk more about how things like content curation through your community is actually kind of interesting. And what other ways that, you know, things that you would maybe like to see in Kickstarter projects that you don't really see.
Well, I think the idea of having some kind of vetted process for the submission of projects isn't necessarily a bad idea. I don't know how they're going to actually judge for that particular site, what they're going to judge. Well, no, there's a private review of the site, and then there's a public vote. There's like two-pronged process. Like having a review process to see if what kind of project it is and if they've met, I guess, all the criteria needed for a successful project, just as sort of like, I mean, I know that Kickstarter kind of has like a sort of a benchmark now for what makes successful projects, more or less, like having the video and having the stuff all set up and, you know, what kind of incentives are good and stuff, and having some way to guide, especially new people, through the process of developing a successful Kickstarter campaign. I think that's kind of a good thing. That would be a nice, you know, sort of thing. Or to say like, you know, well, this project is a great idea, but, you know, maybe you need to think a little bit more about XYZ before you post it and satisfy whatever requirements. I don't think you should necessarily vet it on what it is, because, I mean, that's the whole point of crowdsourcing, is that you get to do things that you might not otherwise be able to do. But having all those marketing things there, guiding people through that process would undoubtedly probably raise the success rate so that people know sort of what they need to do in order to make their success, their campaign successful.
Cool.
Does I'm not familiar with the submission process for Kickstarter, but don't they have some sort of, you have to submit your project to them and then they have to approve it for it to even go up for the crowdfunding?
That's the impression I've always had.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think for like Indiegogo you have to go through any kind of real approval process. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Kickstarter because I'm Canadian and I can't use it.
Kickstarter started invite only.
Maybe
Kickstarter was invite only. So, but yeah, there's probably still like a clearly this is a BS Kickstarter versus this is one that actually has effort.
Right.
So I would assume that there is.
Yeah, and we've all become kind of BS censors for Kickstarters too, I think.
Right.
Especially now that the it's become so popularized.
Right.
So I think that we can all do that. But I still like the idea of an up-down vote. But I guess that you're really voting with your money anyways with Kickstarter.
Yeah.
There's just so many
projects. I'm not
sure
what the public voting phase in Offbeater is going to be exactly. I mean, like if the public people come and just say, yeah, this is a great idea, but don't contribute any money, isn't that kind of like,
that
using
big,
up their goodwill.
That could be, that could be
you
a
know,
problem in the future.
Well, I know that there's like been research and stuff around people who are donating to causes or who are being active in social causes and stuff, where if they have an option to do something like vote or sign a petition or something, they're less likely to, or, you know, they're less likely to give money.
Mm-hmm.
So if the only way for you to vote is with your money, then you're more likely to give money because you're voting with your cash, right? And I guess in Kickstarter, you don't actually spend the cash unless it gets funded, right? Like it doesn't actually go anywhere. You just say, oh, I will pledge if it reaches X amount. So they don't. It's not no risk to them. But I don't know. I just kind of think that, you know, it I don't know if the public vote thing is so important as it is to just, you know, get the people motivated, because it's not really I wouldn't imagine it's the people with supportive communities that have as much problems raising funds as it is people with not as much community.
Well, it depends on the size. I mean, also the size of that supportive community. I think
So if you get like 3 people, it's definitely going to be make a difference to like, you know, 20,000 people.
But if you have 3 people are willing to give you $100 a pop, or 20,000 people are willing to give you less than that, significantly less than that, then I think it makes a difference. The other thing I believe that they had that in there for is to kind of vet projects so that the really good ones wouldn't fall through the cracks, which, we're overloaded with Kickstarter projects right now. I think that some may even be underfunded because they get lost in the shuffle. Maybe there's a better way to do that, and maybe this is it. I don't really think it is for looking at the specs right now, but, I mean, is there any other way to do that?
I can only think of some kind of human-edited, like, feature or something that would bring it to the forefront of people browsing the site, but I don't really know how it would...
I think I know how this works. It looks like in order to even spend money or to contribute money, you have to vote, and then just, you know, versus like there's different levels with different levels of money. I think the votes just count up. I think the votes are donations. I need to make an account and log in, and I think it just counts, basically votes are total number contributions. So I need to actually make an account and check it out more. But I don't know. Yeah. It seems a little. I mean, they're probably gonna change things as things move on. You know, that that happens with companies. So,
Fez, you're going to donate to porn?
I'm gonna make a.
You're gonna make an account.
I'm subscribed to both Slipshine and Filthy Figment. So,
but purely for the site,
for
Webcast Beacon,
for science.
For science. Oh, okay.
Okay. Well.
But it's okay then.
To go back though to we'll go back to the porn for a second. I want to know what the if this is a Kickstarter clone. I wonder what the benefits for different levels will be. I guess maybe a CD and a T-shirt, something else like that. Maybe worse, maybe better. I don't know.
Some of them look like subscription models for like a feed or something like that.
Mm.
I do kind of like the paid content angle.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. And I believe that it's there to help kind of fund the project as a sideline, right?
It seems like that. It's like it's adding like another stream to fund. Like you don't have to wait until if it gets funded or if it doesn't get funded to get something out of it. Like if there's like a magazine, like a magazine or even a comic that, you know, you've never heard of, but you can buy like a PDF of it for like a buck or whatever there and sell it there. Because I mean, a lot of people don't have the ability to do the premium content thing on their websites. It's like, oh, you can read it and go, oh, this is actually really, really good. And go, oh yeah, I totally want to support this being made into print.
Right. And absolutely. I mean, for a CD or something like that, if Kickstarter were to, you know, release a song for, you know, a small amount of money or something that could let you sample. I mean, Kickstarter kind of takes its fingers off of what's going on once it's in that project process and once in the funding process. And all you really see there is if it isn't funded, all that neat stuff that they showed you kind of just goes away unless the project creator decides to release it for free on the internet. So it's a kind of a cool idea. Maybe we'll see more of that. Okay. Well, last thing we want to talk about here is comics on Wednesdays. So Kleefeld has basically decided that it's arbitrary and because of an agreement between DC and between Marvel and Diamond when Marvel's printing arm went out of business or their distribution arm. Is there any significance to anybody here who about Wednesdays? Marie, you said you do it on Wednesdays, but for completely different reasons.
Yeah, I do it on Wednesday because that's when my work schedule works as such that I can actually get my comic done by then. So I can't do it earlier in the week and I can't do it later in the week because otherwise it just doesn't end up working for whatever reason. I've tried. And there's sort of this, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday that everybody's been trained into over the last decade or so, that this is when webcomics come out, is Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It's like the ideal schedule, quote unquote, you know, like that everybody praises as being the ideal schedule. And that's why, you know, Wednesday's the day that works for me. And it works for me in terms of production. It has nothing to do with anything that Marvel or Diamond or anybody did and whenever they did it.
It's not the day you go to the comic book shop?
No, it is not the day I go to the comic book shop. It is not. It's like, no, I just, it just happens to be when my colorist and when I can get the, actual work done. We can get it done by Tuesday, and that's when we get it done. So it goes up Wednesday morning. So it has nothing to do with that at all.
It just, you know, a lot of the places it just fills in the gaps. I mean, just as a webcomic reader, I'm always just looking for whatever's up. I think we all either keep a bookmark or RSS feed, and we know kind of internally, you know, in the back of your head, you know when it's going to be put on the net. And it's weird, though. I mean, how many people, is there any comics out there that you read the day that they come out? I tend to wait until the end of the week and just, like, take an hour after breakfast on Sunday, because there really isn't anything I read anymore.
There's a couple. I read Skin Deep, and I read it religiously on Tuesdays when it comes out. And then there's Dream Scar, which I also read religiously on Fridays when it comes out, although it's on hiatus right now. It makes me sad. The other ones I tend to, like, it depends on if they've got some way of notifying me or not, if I'm really, really interested. I used to follow Maggot Boy really closely, but then I kind of went, and I got bored. So it depends on how, like, there's only really the two that I do read very religiously, and you can tell I obviously know when they update, and neither of them update on Wednesdays. So it really depends on the comic, and I don't really see, especially the long form ones. I mean, I don't know if it's as true with the dailies, but the long form ones tend to just be arbitrary. You know, if they do update regularly, you're lucky. But if, you know, generally speaking, they update when they update, and it really doesn't have anything to do with, I don't think it has anything to do with traditional print schedules at all.
I think it comes down to just choose a schedule, damn it, and stick to it.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, Wednesday's kind of midweek. You've had, you know, like, if you have your weekend and then you know, you're back to work or whatever, you've got Monday and Tuesday to put a comic out, and, you know, there you go. And then you release it as soon as you're done, and then you party for Thursday and Friday or whatever you're doing. I mean, I do sometimes post a bonus pages on Friday if I can get them done, but I have to work like a dog through Wednesday and Thursday to get that done. So it's not an often thing.
Okay. Alex?
I check my... I use Google Reader.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
For all of the comics that I read. If it costs me, that very, very hard for me to become a regular reader of it, which is why I'm like 6 or 7 months behind on Girls with Slingshots, because I lost track of it a couple times. But I check my comics every single day. Generally, this is because I go to the library after work every day to wait out rush hour so that I'm not sitting in traffic for an hour. And I get to use the internet, and everybody wins. So
nobody
yeah, there's
dies.
Not, and nobody wastes any gas, which is awesome. So yeah, I read comics every day. That's just the schedule that works for me. When Alex's guide was on a regular update schedule as opposed to its current intermittent day schedule, I skipped Wednesdays altogether. So I updated on Mondays and Fridays. But there have been other times in the past where, like with Geranos and my previous comic before that, where I updated Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Well, yeah, I think it comes down to pick a schedule.
Yeah.
And that's the end of our discussion section, I believe. Unless
I do got one piece of news that I just found out about. Kelly Turnbull, who is the new third co-host to the Webcomic Beacon, she apparently got into a car accident fairly recently. So she and her friend, or her boyfriend, I'm not sure, they're kind of shaken up, some bruises and some injuries, but they're otherwise all right, I suppose. So best wishes to Kelly Turnbull everybody
and
involved
check out
in that.
The punchline is machismo.com.
Yeah.
Is that where the news bit's up?
That's where her site is, so.
Yeah, but I mean, did she post up there? That sucks.
Yeah, okay. I tweeted with her because she was supposed to be on today. So that's a well-fine excuse that she does not have to apologize for not being there for. So
that's a horrible that she needs to even use that excuse. But that's horrible.
Yeah,
accidents suck.
I had one a year ago and still feeling the shockwaves from that in some ways.
Yep, still shy of the road. That's I live in Jersey, so it's a normal thing, knock on wood.
All right.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, yeah, Kelly, if you're listening, we hope everything's going okay.
And we love you.
Yay. All right.
Platonically, of course. Okay. All right. Well, I think that is the end of our show today. I'd like to thank Fess for stopping in and hanging out with us.
I'm guest.
We get that. I'd also like to thank my co-hosts, Marie Terry of the Shadowcat.com. I'm sorry.
Evil Space Cat.com.
Thank you. I know that.
Jeez, Jason.
And Alex Heberling of alexsguide.net.
Hopefully I'll be on more shows in the very near future and my life calms down a little bit.
And we'd also like to thank you, the listener, for listening in on us. And if you have any comments or questions, please come on over to the website at the, which is now Fest, the WebcastBeacon Network.
Well, it's been always the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com. But if you want just the newscast, go to newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
And look for the notes, which will be up soon. And also, please comment. We love to hear from you. All right. Well, thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.